see it as some type of a Kenyan, possibly a Kenyan Darabana. Now, how could you see it as a Kenyan Daraisa? In what way might it be a Kenyan Atharu? So essentially, there basically are three models by which it could be a Kenyan Atharu. Now, on the one hand, it could be a type of Chalipin. This is something that some of the Achronim discuss. Our sponsor, the Nachli Yitzchak, the Mitzvah Chanan, talks about this in a different area of Shulchan Aruch, but he brings in the subject. That maybe, essentially, once you have kind of started racking up a tab, so there's something on the table. There's, so to speak, a physical item between them, and that could serve as a representative handkerchief or penknife or like something to be kind of a Kenyan Chalipin. A second possibility is that it might be a type of chazaka. That we find that a concept of chazaka in general, in halacha, meaning different things, but there is a concept of chazaka that means you act as if whatever you're trying to accomplish is already in progress. So we gave the example, I think Rav Lichtenstein had made this hara, that there is somewhat of a parallelism. The Mishnah says in Kiddushin, Ha'isha Niknes, B'Shlosha Drachim, B'Kasef, Shtar, Ubiya. And when it comes to the acquisition of Karka, we find three things, Kasef, Shtar, and Chazaka. So it seems like there's an overlapping structure there, with Chazaka and Bia taking up the same place in the slot, same slot in the structure. So what does that slot mean? So perhaps what it means is that a type of Kenyan is acting as if whatever you're trying to accomplish is already true. So in the case of marriage, it's the physical relationship as if that's already in effect. And in the case of Karka, you start living in the area as if you already own it. So that's a Kenyan in and of itself. I mentioned Alpi Derecha Tzachus, that's why I theorized to tend to fall asleep during Kabbalah Shabbos. It's a Kenyan on Shabbos, act like it's already at the time of Menucha. So too, you could argue that there is a Kenyan of a Chazaka in the case of Poland, that once they start working, so that's putting the relationship into effect, and maybe that's a Chazaka itself. And Svarim point out that this is probably true according to both the Rambam and the Ravid. It's Machlokes, the Rambam and the Ravid, in Hilchos Mechira, Perek Aleph, Halacha Kesvav, where the Rambam says that if you're trying to acquire land, so eating the peros of the land is considered to be a chazaka in the context of what we've just been describing. And the Ravid says, no, you need something more than that. But it could be there that when it comes to land, things are a little more complicated. Because since it's possible to acquire land just for the peros, that maybe eating the peros doesn't really show enough of a acquisition of the land itself. But maybe even the Ravid would agree that in the case of the workers, this is already a significant chazaka. This is already something meaningful. And the third possibility is that there's a Kenyan Kesef, that we know that if money changes hands, that could count as a Kenyan Kesef. Right? This is very much a Hazav topic, right? The first Mishnah in Hazav, the whole Machlokas and the Gemara as to what the Iker Kenyan Minatorah is between Jews. It's either Mashicha or Kesef. And as we discussed, it came up in a couple of different contexts. Is a Machlokas what Kenyan Kesef is? Is it a down payment, some payment of some percentage of the value of what's being acquired? Or do we say this is a Machlokas Ataz and the Sma? Do we say that no, we see from the fact that Kesef is used for Kedushin, but it doesn't have anything to do with value. Kedushin, you're not dealing with any kind of monetary value that's relevant. You're dealing with a person of infinite value. So rather, Kenyan Kesef is a symbolic transaction. You give money over as a way of affecting a Kenyan. So neither understanding, maybe you have a Kenyan Kesef here, because maybe essentially once you've started racking up a debt, once the work has started to take place, so now there is somewhat of a debt between the employer and the employee, so then maybe that mamashus can serve as a Kenyan Kesef. So all of these are possible ways of saying that we have a Kenyan Min HaTorah beyond what has been suggested by other Rishonim in terms of this relationship.
Now, it's also interesting to take things a little further and to deepen it a little bit, that, okay, so starting the malacha, perhaps, could be construed as a kinyan based on any of the things that we've said so far. But specifically, the Gemara's emphasis on halicha, right? It's really two different steps. We saw that in the Rishonim, we mentioned yesterday in the Rashba, that the Rashba basically says that haskalah is a kinyan, and halicha is haskalah's haskalah, it's the beginning of the beginning. That's the first step. Hi.
That's something going on a uman, correct? It means a poem.
Probably, we'll get to that in a minute. That's what it sounds like, but we'll get to it in a minute because actually there's a little bit of nuance there. So it seems like, okay, well, everything we've said so far, we've only really addressed the idea that it's about a haskalah. Why the fact that halicha is considered to be a haskalah specifically, we haven't really addressed yet. But a number of achronim, such as the Avnei Nezer and others, point to a Gemara later on in Bava Metzia and Daf Pei Gimel, where the Gemara has an interesting din that a poel, Knisaso Mishalatzmo, Vitsiaso Mishal Balabayas, that when Knis and Itzi, it's a little confusing because they sound like they mean opposite things, but here they really mean two things in the same process. Let's say the worker has a job in Philadelphia, so he travels tonight to sleep over in Philadelphia, so that's his Knisa into the town, so that he does on his own time. And then in the morning, he's got to travel from his place of lodging to the place of work, that's his Itzia. So that is Mishal Balabais. That's on the boss's time. That he does from the time the boss is paying him. So a number of Acharonim say, see, this is very interesting. This plugs into what we see here, that Holchu is considered to be the beginning of the Malacha, because the Halicha takes place on the time of the boss. So the boss is paying for the Halicha. So especially if you want to take two of the three theories we just used, right, the Kesef or the Chalipin theory, both of those are premised on there being a Shavapruta of value. Chazak is a little bit of a different type of approach, but the other two, the Kesef and Chalipin approaches, are premised on there being a Shavapruta of value, so maybe the value starts racking up as soon as they start the trip to the actual work site. So maybe that's why Holchu is considered to be a significant stage of a haskalah. That's how a lot of achronim understood. Now, that's a fascinating idea in general. It has a couple of implications. Now, first of all, some of the contemporaries farm, especially for these Chazara Shirim, I want to kind of reduce, and I try to say things with Shem Omro, but I also don't want to give you the impression you have to remember every name of every later Sefer. So, especially with the Chazara sessions, sometimes reduce citations just to not create a focus that way. Especially these contemporaries, Svarim and Poland, they all have very similar sounding titles. So if you're going to put a lot of emphasis in, you know, I'm certainly happy to provide you with all the makoros, but if you don't want to focus on remembering whether it was the Mishpate Choshen or Mishpate Poland, I don't blame you. So I'm not emphasizing them during the Chazar session. But so some discuss. It's one thing, on the one hand, that Gemara seems very helpful. Okay, the Gemara that says that the Balabais pays for the traveling time is very relevant and very helpful, except that it's not so relevant, because it's almost never true lahalacha. Because the Gemara itself raises the question that why do I have to have such a din telling me that I pay for, as an employer, I pay for the worker's travel time? This is the kind of thing that's usually established by minig. So let's look at the minig, and whatever they do, they do. I don't have to have the Gemara tell me what the rule should be. It's a general, by the way, a question the Gemara asks a lot, that the Gemara has expression, the first Tosfos in Baba Basra. Gemara is elsewhere in Baba Masiyah. So when do we say HaKol Kaminig HaMedina? And then the Rishonim say, well, if it's this concept of HaKol Kaminig HaMedina, why do we bother trying to discuss halachas at all? It's a big Tosfos in Baba Basra talks about this. It's a side topic. But here, so the Gemara says that this is going to be established by Minig, so why do we need to have such a halacha? So the Gemara says, well, you can imagine, let's say you have a city that started from scratch and there's no Minig. So we need to know what the abstract rule would be. Or let's say you have a condition where the worker and the employer, they made a deal, they're going to follow whatever the din of the Gemara is. So we need to know what the din of the Gemara is, because that's what they're going to follow. So in those unusual scenarios, so we need to know this din. But in real life, it's not going to be so relevant, it seems. In real life, whatever the minig is. So what's the minig in America, for example? Right, presumably, it's not in keeping with this din. Because if your job expects, if you work on the clock, and you're expected to be at your job from 9 to 5, so they don't say, well, if you live 10 minutes away, you can count your travel time. We say if you live 10 minutes away, you got to leave at 8:50, and if you live 2 hours away, you got to leave at 7. You can't count your traveling time as part of the on-the-clock time. So the minig in America is that the clock starts counting when you show up, not when you start traveling for work. So that's an example of a prevalent approach, which is not the din of the Gemara. So maybe you'll say, okay, so this could have been a great suggestion, but it's not true. In practice, it's usually not the case that the poel is getting paid for his traveling time. So why should we consider that to be significant as far as halacha? So those who raise this question say at the same time they don't think it's a problem, because the minig means that, okay, the minig is we don't actually give you the money that the Gemara says could have been there for your traveling time. That we have an understanding between us, you're not actually going to get paid for that. You're going to have to do that on your own time. But the Gemara's abstract statement is still relevant. And this is a fascinating point, especially because this issue has been beneath the surface of so many of our sugyas, right? The question of whether there's a halachic recognition of poel as an identity. So here as well, we've seen it just come up a couple of times in various contexts, so here it's coming up as well, that the Gemara is relevant to tell you he's a poel from the time of the halicha. The poel relationship has started. Is he actually going to pay him for that time? Maybe not. But that doesn't take away from the significance of the Gemara that the haskalas hamalacha is from that time. Now then you have to work it out, but if you're saying, but it's all based on the fact that you're getting paid specifically and there's money racking up, so then you have to figure out if that still works. Now from the chazaka approach, this is now better, because chazaka doesn't really require that there actually be money on the table. It requires just that you started the work. So the Gemara is saying the work starts with the halicha, and that abstractly the balabayas should pay for the halicha. Maybe the minig will be the balabayas doesn't pay for the halicha, but the abstract truth is still there that he starts working on his clock from that time. Aaron?
It's being explained with the two Magdavan worms there, whether that's halicha or
Astala. In terms of what? In terms of...
According to one that says that it's a minig. When he starts, but not when he goes.
Right.
So according to that, how do you understand this minig? When he's walking there, so there wouldn't be a pole relationship?
I mean, when he's traveling to the city itself, but can you say so? Yeah, apparently not. He's not working as a pole during that time. He's only working as a pole when he's actually physically going to the job. And therefore, abstractly, he should get paid for that time too. But the common minig will be whatever it is. It happens to be that it's usually not paid for that. But the poel relationship has started. Now, it'll be your other point from before. So there are those who have suggested that, and this is a discussion in the Avnei Nezer and in the Nachal Yitzchak as well, that maybe we should say, okay, so this is all true for a poel, but not for a kabbalim. Right? A kabbalim presumably is not paid for his traveling time. This din of poel v'yitzchiyotso, it's only true about a poel who's paid by the hour. The kabbalin is paid for the work, so the work is done whenever it's done. So that may or may not be true. There is a lot of detailed discussion in the later svarim, and just, you know, some of the svaras that go back and forth, again, without trying to focus on who says what. But so there's a couple of points that can be raised. That theoretically you say, right, okay, a kabbalin is not paid for his traveling time. He's paid only to do the actual work. But what if the nature of the work is he has to be in a certain location in order to do it? So if you ask him to fix my shoes, so he can take his shoes to his office and he can do it whenever it's good for him, wherever it's good for him. But if I ask him to fix my house, so he's got to come to my house, and maybe the traveling to my house should be counted. So there were some who thought that that was a compelling point, that the kabbalin becomes on the clock during the traveling time in those circumstances. And others thought not that way, except an extreme. What do you mean by an extreme? So we gave an example like this. Let's say I want work done in my house in Bergen County. So I ask a contractor in Bergen County. So he knows, he generally works in Bergen County. Some cities take him 10 minutes to get to, some take him 15 minutes to get to, some take him 5 minutes to get to, some he has to pay tolls, some he doesn't pay tolls, but he knows this is all where he works, and that's not something he charges for. He comes to your house, that's understood, and he has a boundaries of where he normally works, and that's all considered to be a part of the costs he absorbs. But what if I were to say to this guy, listen, I know you generally work in Bergen County, but I want you to work on my mansion in Utah because you're the best, so I want you to come to Utah to work on my house there. So then, that's an unusual kind of thing. Presumably the traveling is going to be on me. And there the traveling is above and beyond, so that's going to be a different kind of relationship. So clearly there's a lot of subjectivity and a lot of detail here, but there is a back and forth in terms of how a poll will fit into this equation, whether or not he'll be subject to the same type of understandings. And then there's a lot of discussion, also a lot of nuanced discussion in terms of what's called halchu, what's called hischilu. So let's say that worker invests in materials for the job. Is that called a haskala or not? So that there's a little bit of debate about. It depends what kind of materials. Is it materials that he needs for every job, just he happens to be getting them because you're up first, but he could equally use them for another job? Or are they materials that are only good for your job? Are they part of his training? There's a machlokus about this, if this is part of what he needs just to be a well-equipped person. And there was a discussion, what if you, let's say, you hire a tutor and he prepares the material to teach. So do we say he's doing that as part of the job, or that's a part of what he does, so he'll be qualified? You go to law school so that you're an educated lawyer, and now you can charge because you're an educated lawyer, but you don't make them pay for your law school. Or do you say, where do you draw the line? So you see where there's a lot of room for debate here. At what point am I doing work on behalf of the employer, or at what point am I doing work so that I will be a marketable, skilled person, and I'm not really doing it for you, I'm doing it to invest in my own marketability? You can see where there's some room for debate about that, so all of this gets into the question of what's called haschalas hamalacha, where things change. The poskim also assume that if you go to the work site just to scope it out, that's probably not considered a haschala. That's in fact a non-haschala. That's part of what you do in order to decide whether to take a job in the first place. So that maybe by its very nature is not a haschala. And then there are all kinds of interesting sfeikas in the svarim also. Let's say you go for a couple jobs at once. So is that considered to be haschala lagabe all the bosses? Or let's say you go for a haschala for a couple jobs one after another. Like let's say you're a traveling doctor who goes to different communities and then sees appointments one after the other. What's considered to be a haschala under those circumstances? All of this is debated in the later literature and all plugs into this broader discussion. So again, there are a few other details and nuances, but I think those are the basic outlines of what we talked about in terms of that sugya. Any issues or questions about that? Okay, so let's try to talk about Poel Yochel Achzer. We'll try to get most of it done quickly now, and we'll maybe have a few minutes to spill over into our session tomorrow morning. So the Gemara has a din in a number of places. It shows up in our parak, where it directly flows out of all the issues we talked about. Again, everything's in a straight line from the Mishnah. Everything ties into those dinim. And it shows up in our previous parak, in last semester's parak, in the first parak in Daf Yud. And it shows up in a few other places as well. And the basic premise is Poel Yochel Achzer V'Chatzi Yom. A Poel has the ability to quit in the middle of the day. And this seems to modify what the Mishnah originally starts off talking about, where the Mishnah says that there are basic expectations vis-a-vis a Poel and his employer as to who can quit on the other when and what are the circumstances. So apparently there's a special schus to the Poel that he can quit. And the first parak, it's brought up in a little bit of a confusing context. It's not really clear what the maskana of the Gemara is, but it's brought up in terms of what does it say about the nature of the relationship. If a poel finds something when he's working for the boss, so is he considered to be like the boss? Is he considered to be Yad Balabais? And therefore whatever he finds belongs to the boss? Or is he considered to be his own man and whatever he finds belongs to him? So the Gemara tries to question that whole issue by noting Poel Yochel Achzer V'Chatzi Yom, because a Poel can quit, so maybe that means he's not the property, so to speak, of the Balabais. So all of this reflects the fact that the Gemara has a pasuk. We just read this past Shabbos, Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim, that we are meant to be avadim for God, v'lo avadim la'avadim, not to be avadim for human beings. So we noted a couple of questions about what this whole din means, a couple of broader questions. First of all, are we basically saying that this is something of an isser, or is this a schus for the poel? Is the Torah telling us that a poel is defined a certain way, and he gets a certain benefit in a default situation? Or is this really an instruction to the poel himself, for the poel is prohibited from entering into a situation that looks too much like avdus, because he would be in violation of Kili B'nei Yisrael Avadim? That was one of the questions that we dealt with in a broader sense. Another question that we dealt with is this, which is very much related to that issue, is a poel a specific construct in the Torah, and that's therefore relevant to what a poel is? Or are we talking about Benadam L'Chavero arrangements where any facts can come together to create a deal between two parties? And we just have a shorthand. We talk about a poel and a malva and a lova and a shoel and whatever it is in order to talk about what the usual expectations are. But they could change and they could be adapted however they are, but this is just what a default poel is. And also we raise the question that comes out, I think, throughout the sugya as well, that what's the nature of this rule of Kili B'nei Yisrael Avadim, whoever is talking to, whether it's talking to the boss or it's talking to the employee, is it really specifically about this specific din, Poel Yochel Achzor? Or no, it really means something more abstract, that you can't have an Eved relationship with people. And the details, maybe that's Masar and Akasa L'Chachamim, Chachamim are going to decide which details are important and which ones aren't, but it's really, as far as the Torah is concerned, it's not about Chazara, it's about you can't be an Eved. And this is provoked by the fact that we seem to see a lot of ambiguities here, which makes it sound very drabanan. Dick was quoting a pasuk, but it sounds very drabanan the way it plays out, and some of the details indeed are assumed to be drabanan by some of the svarim, but that we find that there are circumstances by which a poel can be chozer, but it's still called a chevet, it's still called an evet, and we find there are situations maybe where he can't be chozer, but he's not called an evet. So it doesn't sound so much like it's really a kpeid on this specific detail, as much as this is a stand-in for the whole concept that a poel should not be treated like an evet. So within those frameworks, so we looked at some of the details. So one of the Har Gemara tells us that the poel can quit. We know that, as the Torah points out, it seems to be the significance here as well, that one of the major reflections of that fact is that he has the upper hand in terms of his salary. So let's say workers, when I hired this worker, it cost $8 a day to get work done. And he quit halfway through. And now it costs me $10 a day. So I owe him $4 for his half a day work, but if I want to get a worker to finish the day, so it's going to cost me now $5. So I had originally expected to spend $8, so maybe I should only pay this guy $3 so I could take that extra dollar out and still come up with my same final bill. So that's what we're told. No, that the poel has the right to his salary for what he did, and therefore he worked $4 worth, he gets his $4, even though now to finish it's going to cost me more. So that seems to be one of the premises. We also find there's a discussion in the Tosus and Maseches Kiddushin, a very important Tosus, where the Gemara talks about an Eved. Let's say an Eved gets sick, so he's not able to work. Let's say he's sick in an objective way, it's an onus. So should we say that, okay, the 6 years he was going to be an Eved, we'll subtract the time that he's sick because he's not working? So the Gemara says, at least up to 50%, it is the case the Gemara is talking about, if he's sick for 3 years, we don't say he's got to work an extra 3 years. Those 3 years were the loss to the balabayas, and good luck for the Eved, so to speak, that he was sick all that time. So Tosa says, so would you also say, let's say you have a tutor, you have a worker who's working on the clock, and he's sick half the time. So let's say, okay, so I should have to pay him for that time, same way the Eved gets paid. So Tosa says, no, there's a fundamental difference between the Eved and the worker. Kili B'nei Yisrael Avadim, we don't treat them the same way. And that provokes a whole discussion that essentially what it means is that an Eved for this purpose is basically viewed like property. So let's say, for example, if you bought a car So the fact is, maybe you expected, you calculated, you'll get 3 good years of service out of the car. That's what you assumed when you bought it. And it turns out the car's been a mess, and for a year of the time, it's been in the shop. It hasn't worked for a year. So you can't go back to the seller and say, I want a third of my money back because I didn't get a year of the 3 years. Because, no, he sold you something, so it's yours. So whatever problems you have are your problems. The same way, let's say, for a house. A person owns his house opposed to renting. So if something breaks in the house, he gets the superintendent to fix it. He gets the landlord to fix it. But if he owns the house, so it's his problem. So he can't subtract it from the purchase price, generally. When you own it, it's yours. You take on all the problems. So the Eved, okay, you expected to get 6 years of work. In 3 years, you couldn't work. That's your problem. But with a Poel, so you're paying him to work. And if he can't work, so then he shouldn't necessarily get paid for that time. So it's not the same. There's a fundamental difference between the Eved and the Poel. And as we illustrated, the whole question is not so foreign to us, because in our contemporary society, we do have somewhat of a mix of this issue, that there is a concept. On the one hand, workers are paid to work. They're not treated like a abadim. It's not the property of the owner, but we do have a concept within a certain threshold, to a certain degree. There is a concept of sick leave, that there is the idea that the cost of the illness should be borne by the employer is not totally foreign by us, at least to some degree. And that's the Havamina Tosfos has based on this Gemara Bet Eved. It says ultimately that's the difference between an Eved and a Poel. So in other words, it's not just the Schus Chazara, but the Schus Chazara tells you about a whole different nature in terms of the relationship. And Tosfos there also brings up the whole issue of 3 years being a significant number. It's a pasuk in Yeshaya that says that the term of a worker is 3 years. And there is a pasuk in Parshas Re'eh that says, don't feel bad about freeing your slave after 6 years, because he worked for you twice the time of an Eved, twice the time of a Poel, so twice the 3 years. So we have this notion that a worker is for 3 years. So based on that, you have some who say, even though Tosfos in our Masechta says there's no Isser to hire yourself out, that's not a violation of Libnei Yisrael Avadim, but some Rishonim, such as the Mordechai, and the Ramah quotes this, say, but not more than 3 years. And then there's the whole discussion, does that mean you can't take any job for more than 3 years? Clearly our minhag is not that way. We certainly sign contracts for more than 3 years. So some say it really depends on what we're talking about. Are we talking about a situation where maybe you go to a machmir, and by the way, the Ksos says this whole din is drabanan. This is again an example of where there's somewhat of a vague nature to this din of Kili B'nai Shal Vadim. So the Ksos says it's drabanan. But some say that it only means if you're living in the boss's house and you're there 24-7, but people who don't live in the boss's house are not subject to such a restriction. In other Makoros, it's clearly not the assumption, but still, maybe the idea is you're on the clock constantly, you can't take any vacation during those 3 years, there's no break. So maybe that's when you have an issue. But in a contemporary arrangement where you have some kind of a break and you have the ability to take off, so then maybe we wouldn't necessarily be subject to this. And you saw the Chavos Yair, who has a tshuva about a chazan, who made an arrangement for more than 3 years and then wanted to claim Kli B'nei Yisrael Avadim. And the Chavos Yair thought that maybe he doesn't have the right to say that because he's not working for Avadim, he's working for God if he's a chazan. So he's really doing a mitzvah, maybe it's not subject to this whole thing. The Ksos argued on this. That was a whole discussion of itself. So one of the, where we are going to have to continue this topic a little bit tomorrow, hopefully it shouldn't be a problem to finish this topic tomorrow, we'll just have to say a few more ideas, but just one major lumdish idea to get out on the table before the close of B'chatzi Yom, but an important lumdish concept here, is so there is a machlokus as to how this works. That the Tshuvas Maimoni, that the Ksos and others quote, understands that this is a concept of Giron Kesef, that basically it's a Kal V'chomer from Eved. That we know that an Eved can buy himself out. If an Eved gets the money, so he can give the money to his master to get himself out early, and that's called Giron Kesef. So some understands what the Tshuvas Maimoni says, that this is a kal v'chomer to an eved, to a poel. A poel is not an eved, so the pasuk says, right? You're not a vadin. So if an eved can do this, a poel for sure can do this. So a poel does it, be giron kesef. How does it work, be giron kesef for him? Because since he deserves to get paid, and he gets paid at the end, because the schiris of a poel is after the work is done, so he's racking up all this salary, And if he forfeits the salary by deciding to stop working early, so whatever he forfeited, it's ki'ilu he bought himself back with that money. And that's basically what's going on, is the Giron Kesef. But the Ksos and many others disagree, and others point out, it's probably Tosus's view as well against this, that no, it's not true, that we don't see it as a kal v'chomer limit, that it's just that Paul is not evident at all. He's not owned by the Balabas, so he doesn't have to buy himself back. It's not working that way. And further proof, as the Ksos notes, that it doesn't work that way is the Psak of the Maharik that the Shulchan Aruch quotes, that this din of Paul Yachal Achzer would be true even if he happens to have received all of his salary in advance, so he's already been paid, and he's not in a position to pay it back. So there's no sense of the word in which he is buying himself back from the boss right now. The boss is not getting any of his money back. He paid it out and he's not getting it. He'll have to get it back eventually. It'll be a chov. He'll have to figure out how to get his money returned to him. But it's not necessary for the chazara to take place. The chazara can happen even without the boss getting paid back. And that seems to be a raya, from the halacha paskin and Shulchan Aruch and other rishonim as well, that that's not the understanding. It's not a giron kesef evad kind of thing, but it's simply that that's not the nature of the relationship.
We saw someone, I think it was in the Ashivet Tzvat, brought down that there's someone who disagrees with that. Chassam Sofer says that if you don't have the money on you, the Balabais can...
Well, he may have to write a shtar. The Ksos talks about that also. They may have to deal with how to get it paid back. But it seems like it's against the Tshuvas Maimonides. It seems like it works against the Giron Kesef idea. But, there is a discussion in Poskim about how to address the chov that will be for the Balabais, and that maybe we should... Maybe there's another issue that someone's farmer, I don't know if we discussed in the Yashiv Yitzchak or not, but some discuss that maybe it should be a problem in a Bedavar Avud. Why don't we say, Shach talks about this, why don't we say that if a worker can't pull out in a way that's going to cause a loss to the Balabais, so then isn't this a loss to the Balabais? Isn't this a Davar Avud? If he got paid already, he's not going to pay it back. So isn't that a Davar Avud? So you have to get into the question a little bit of what a Davar Avud is. Davar Avud might mean that the job is going to be missing something because the worker pulls out, but not that there's a side chov. Okay, so the side chov, he'll get paid back sometime in the future. He'll eventually get his money back. But davar avod means that the wedding is not going to have a singer, the funeral is not going to have somebody come to do kinos, and there's never going to be a way to fix that. So then that's a davar avod. But right now he has a loss, but eventually it will hopefully get paid back. That's not necessarily considered to be a davar avod. So there's a little bit of discussion about that. I'm not sure if that's what you're alluding to. Okay, so that's it's a good chunk of Paul Yachal Achzer. We have a few minutes left. We should be able to cover it tomorrow morning. I have no concerns that we won't finish that. Just we'll have to see what extra stuff we can get done.